podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Hello, welcome back. Happy New Year. Kalle Kristujana, if you are in the Orthodox Church and celebrating Christmas today after Twelfth Night has passed. We are Tennis Unfiltered in 2024. A brand new look. No, it's not brand new. It's not new look. It's still us. It's me, James Gray of iNews.co.uk, George Belshaw, and our resident tennis coach, Calvin Betton. This is a cross-hemisphere podcast today, as the next four or five will be. Calvin is in Adelaide. I'm still in London, but literally sat next to my suitcase, which is ready to get on the plane with me this evening. George, where are you in the glamorous world and where are you going?
I'm back in London and I'm staying in London. So I'll be our constant during this period of turmoil.
You'll be our rock, George, our northern star, to quote Shakespeare. Calvin, I know that we're trying to get through this podcast as quickly as possible so you can actually get some sleep. Talk us through your latest travel journey over the last 24 hours.
I left Thailand some stage yesterday. I don't even know what day we're on at the minute. I left Thailand somewhere, I guess, around 36 hours ago, maybe.
Okay.
And then flew from Bangkok to Bali. I had 8 hours stopover in Bali. The funny thing with the stopover, because I know I had 8 hours, but in Bali you have to self-transfer. You can't; they don't do any transfers for you. And in order to do that, you need a visa. You have to go out of departure side, arrival side, back into departures. So you have to get a visa anyway. Now, when you apply for the visa, it says that on the website, it says that the wait for a visa could be lengthy and is not guaranteed. But you have to get one there. You have to get one at the place. You can't get one in advance. So I thought, well, I've got 8 hours to kill, so that'll probably, I'd kind of put aside 3 hours of that to get a visa. Knowing that when the plane landed, I basically forced myself out of the plane first and sprinted to the visa desk, and it took all of about 7 seconds to get the visa. They basically say, how do you want to pay? And that's it. So then my whole, I thought I'd have like 6 hours spare in Bali, but in the end I had 8 hours.
Is it an airport you could recommend? Did you leave the airport?
No, I thought about it. If I'd have been earlier in the day, then I would have done, because it's obviously a very nice place, but I didn't get there until, I think I got there at 6 o'clock at night. And I left at 1 in the morning, I think. So it's a very nice airport. It's probably the best airport I've ever been to be fair.
There you go. I'm always looking for good airports to transit through. This time I'm transiting through Shanghai, which is supposed to be a decent airport, but it's not exactly on the way to Australia. So it means I'm doing 2 11-hour flights.
What was so good about it, Calvin?
It was just very clean. The places where I always look for in airports, because I go to quite a lot, clean benches that you can lie down on, that don't have armrests all through the bench, looks safe enough, and most importantly, good food outlets.
Yeah,
good affordable food outlets. And it had all of those. Although strangely, like, I've noticed in airports now, I don't know where any of our listeners have seen this, or either of you guys, but like, who's buying stuff at airports? Because the stuff is so expensive.
Yeah.
Like now, this airport in Bali, just it had literally a Gucci, a Ralph Lauren, Louis Vuitton, it had a Wolfgang Puck restaurant. And I'm like, who's buying this stuff at airports?
I guess it's if you're doing it tax free, like if you're, but I mean,
yeah,
that's the only thing I can think. And you know, they're like, oh, I haven't done enough tax free shopping, or what, you know, I've got a bit left in my allowance. Like, you know, let's just make sure I fill up the tank. I don't know.
Yeah,
it is
strange.
But again,
I mean, I guess Bali's quite a big influencer spot, isn't it? They're probably picking up some man bags and stuff like that.
Yeah, quite. I always recommend this to people. Singapore Airport is one of the best to transit through. And if you go to Terminal 4, and they're all connected by a little shuttle, so it's easy enough to get around, there is a place you can pay about 20 Singapore, 20 US dollars, and there's a bar and a swimming pool and a jacuzzi, and it's outdoors. And you can go, you don't have to like go through immigration or anything, you can just go and sit there, have a beer in the pool. And last time I was there, I had 3 hours in Singapore, And I was like, I don't care. I might miss my flight. I don't care. I'm getting in the pool. And it made... Oh, wow.
I'd give a shout out for the butterfly garden as well. That's
the butterfly? Lovely. Is there a butterfly garden?
Yeah, yeah. My stopover was only there an hour, so I didn't have time to do the whole thing. But yeah, there's a little kind of butterfly garden that you can just walk through and have nice butterflies fly around you. It's very nice.
I shall remember that next time. If anyone's got any recommendations for Shanghai Airport and they're able to get them out in the next couple of minutes, that'd be great. We've briefly lost Calvin, but we will get him back, I am sure. Right, well, we would usually start with some listener questions, but we've got breaking news this morning, which we have to start with, which is that Rafael Nadal is out of the Australian Open. Having been playing in Brisbane and looking pretty good, he has withdrawn just a day before qualifying. I mean, it means it doesn't mess the draw up too much. He says, "Hi, all. During my last match in Brisbane, I had a small problem on a muscle that, as you know, made me worried." He had a medical timeout during the match against Jordan Thompson. He says, "Once I got to Melbourne, I've had the chance to have an MRI. I've got a micro tear on a muscle, not in the same part where I had the injury, his hip injury, of course, from which he's coming back. And that's good news. Right now, I'm not ready to compete at the maximum level of exigence in five-set matches." Lovely translation there. "I'm flying back to Spain to see my doctor and get some treatment and rest. I worked very hard during the year for this comeback. And as I always mentioned, my goal is to be at my best level in 3 months. Within the sad news for me, not being able to play in front of the amazing Melbourne crowds, this is not very bad news. And we all remain positive with the evolution of the season. I really wanted to play here in Australia, and I've had the chance to play a few matches. That made me very happy and positive. Thanks for all the support, and see you soon, Rafa." George, your kind of instant reaction, I suspect, is one slightly of smugness, because you did, in fact, say that this would happen.
Yeah, I think it's just kind of one of those classic things, isn't it? We're watching Rafa this week, and we're thinking, "Oh, yeah, he looks quite sharp. Looks like he's played quite well." People are suddenly starting to say, "Oh, he's going to have a deep run at Australia." I was like, probably more realistic, some small thing will go wrong, and he'll have to withdraw. That's not really just a kind of Rafa comment. It's more anyone who comes back from a long injury is probably more susceptible to small things going wrong in their body. And, you know, he understandably wants to be quite cautious this year, I think. With all due respect to Australia, this is probably up there with the events he feels least likely capable of winning this year.
Do you think?
Yeah, definitely. With Novak's record there, he's only won it twice. And, you know, the two times he's not had to face Novak, really. So, you know, Novak's so dominant there and Alcaraz is so good on hard courts. You know, he'd in my opinion, much more fancy chances, obviously, at the French Open, but also the US Open. I think those conditions have suited him more throughout his career. So, I'm not saying I think he could have played, but I don't think he would have wanted to take the risk given the bigger events for him and what potentially could be the final season of his year. It's obviously a shame. You know, there's quite a lot of comebacks, aren't there, this year that I'm sure we'll kind of talk through going on in the podcast. But, you know, given of those comebacks, Nadal's feels the one that we're really not going to see this guy probably beyond this year. It's not a great start, but hopefully, as he says, it's nothing too bad and we'll see him in a few weeks.
Calvin, as George said, I don't know how much of that you caught, but not the biggest surprise in the world that Rafa's picked up a niggle and is out of the Australian Open, but it is a shame, isn't it? You know, he adds a certain something to the tournament. We've lost Calvin again. That is a shame. Well, it's funny, yeah, foregone conclusion. I was out for drinks on Friday with a listener. Hi, Danny. He was saying to me that, you know, the tennis last year at the Australian Open actually didn't light things up. And George, I think that's right. Like, if you actually think about it, Murray carried us through the first week with that storyline. Kyrgios gave us the pre-tournament intrigue. And then second week, it was like no one got near Novak. You know, people were talking about the hamstring like for days because it was all there was to talk about. There wasn't really a huge amount of tennis-based intrigue, and I think Rafa would at least have given us that, even if it was only through to the fourth round. We just need that, don't we? But do you think maybe that Alcaraz will fill that gap?
Yeah, I think Novak's going to win the Australian Open, but I don't think that's a controversial opinion. But Alcaraz has shown he can go toe-to-toe with this guy in big matches. It'd be interesting to see where Yannick Sinner picks off at the end of the last season. It felt like he was getting a bit of joy against Novak in in best of three, at least. I think best of five is obviously a different kettle of fish. Medvedev's had some success out there before. So there's definitely guys who can make it difficult. And I think if we get those four in the semi-finals, we'll probably have had a pretty good tournament on the men's side. But yeah, I mean, this is the slam where Novak just knows how to get the job done so well. It's probably the slam he's most supported at in many ways. There's a decent kind of Serb contingency out in Australia. I think he feels most comfortable there, which is not surprising that it's on a hard court. I can't really look past him at the minute. There's the usual noises about a problem, isn't there, with the kind of wrist thing, which, you know, the wrist is probably something that has come up time and time again for the longest period in some ways with Novak. It seems like he's often fiddling with a wrist. Never seems to be terminal, but he is, what, turning 37 this year? So I guess every year it becomes more likely something does go more seriously wrong. But yeah, right now, hard to look past him still, I think.
You mentioned Novak's wrist there, George. Calvin, Nick Kyrgios's take, change of balls every week, finally got to Novak's wrist. The ATP really need to do something about this problem. Players suffer all the time.
Yeah, which might hold some weight if he hadn't been playing with the same balls for the last 4 weeks after 2 weeks off, and will be using those balls for the next 4 weeks, 3 weeks from now. Like, just an absolute nonsense. Like, if there's one time of the year where you can't argue too many ball changes, it's roundabout right now.
Yeah. We mentioned the balls. I saw you post something about the balls in humidity, presumably in Thailand. What do you make of this year's Australian Open balls? There was a lot of chat about them last year in Melbourne that they weren't up to scratch. They don't seem to respond to humidity well. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, well, I mean, the whole point of them is they're supposed to be a humidity defying ball. Now, you know, if you think about, if you think about what humidity does to hair, for people who have long hair, it makes it frizzy.
Calvin Betton, expert on hair and humidity.
I wouldn't know anything about that. Yeah. But yeah, that's what it tends to do in humidity. But so the felt on a ball will react the same. Now, what happens then is you get extra drag through the air because of that. The ball increases in size, and there's more. The aerodynamics go down on it, which is what you'd expect from a tennis ball. But they've made this big thing about how they've designed this ball to cope with humidity better, and I don't see as it is at all. I mean, it's not like, I'm not going to say it's worse than a normal ball. It's just not any different. And the ball that when we were in, I mean, I'll say this: in Thailand last week, it was extremely hot and extremely humid. I would say even more than it's going to be in Australia. And the courts were also very slow and very rough, which combined with a rough court will rough up the ball and make it even more frizzy and fluffy. So that was probably even more extreme than you'd get in Australia. But I've been in Australia today, to be honest. We've practiced today twice.
Well, we wait with interest. I know Emma Raducanu mentioned, and a couple of other people in Auckland mentioned, that, you know, Auckland is not a particularly hot and humid place, that the balls are fluffing up. And there is Calvin gone again. We will never know exactly what happened to Skander Mansouri's serve. We're gutted. I mean, Calvin will perhaps send us some voice notes of bits and pieces that I can maybe pop on the end, but he is on hotel Wi-Fi in Adelaide, and it's just not holding up, unfortunately. When I get out to Melbourne, Calvin will be joining me, and we will do some stuff live. And the foibles of Wi-Fi will not be something that bother us too much. Right. Well, we'll move on, and we'll hear more from Calvin next week, hopefully. Right, let's move on to some listener questions. A few of them are sort of quite Calvin adjacent, so I'm not gonna use them. But there are one or two that I wanted to raise. Well, one really from Nikos, who is a regular listener and a regular question asker, and who has some excellent advice for Calvin after his struggles to get a can of Coke in rural France last year. I will share that advice with him. George, the Alimentation Générale, or the épicerie, usually run by Maghreb immigrants, as they're known as Arab markets, are the places to go if you're struggling to get a proper can of Coke. And they're also open pretty late. So there you go. Good to know. But Nichols has a couple of other questions. For starters, George, he says, I'm a big George fan and think he contributes the most in terms of player analysis, deserve more credit and less slagging off. Couldn't agree less, Nikos. But anyway, there we go.
That's made my 2024 already. I think that'll be tough.
That's big for you, George. Well done. Read your general coverage on the pod. I agree with others that it feels unfavourable to Djokovic at times, but it's mostly just Calvin doing mental gymnastics to avoid crediting him as the GOAT. To defend Calvin in his absence, he has regularly said that he thinks Novak Djokovic is the GOAT. People always seem to forget this. But anyway, Nico says, I'm a Sabalenka fan, though, and I think your coverage of her has been quite harsh at times, especially during Roland Garros this year. I also think she had a much more impressive year than Świątek, even if the latter finished with a minuscule points edge, but only got past Slam quarterfinals once. While Sabalenka did it at all of them. George, particularly prudent to be having this conversation, given that I woke up to Elena Rybakina 6-3, 6-love over Aryna Sabalenka, which is maybe a little unfair, given that she did, in fact, make the final in Brisbane, beating Lin Zhu, Kasatkina, Azarenka on the way without ever breaking a sweat. So I suppose the question here is, how do you judge someone's year? How do you judge a player? Is it at the Grand Slams or is it their overall season?
Well, I think it personally depends player to player. So for me, Sabalenka has probably been one of the most consistent players on either tour, really, at tour level for the last 6 years, maybe. Mm.
Which is ironic, given her game style, right? It's actually quite inconsistent.
Yeah, and I think with her, the big question, this is why I kind of championed her as one of the most improved players last year, even though Calvin didn't really see kind of weight in this as much. But the big change for her was really translating that form on the tour into the Grand Slams. And for me, she did do that last year. I think she made the semis of all four Slams. Reached the final of 2-1-1. That's really, really consistent form, and it's not really form I'm expecting to go too far away. I think, you know, she is comfortably the second best player in the world right now, and, you know, as Nikos says, there were times last year where she was the best player in the world, and she's done well to kind of narrow the gap with Świątek. I still think Świątek has a more well-rounded game and probably is still more mentally resolute in big moments, you know, for as well as Sabalenka did. You know, the French Open semi-final against Mukova was a huge disappointment. You know, any match you're 5-2 up to get into a big match and then you collapse, really. There's no other kind of word around it, as well as Mukova did to kind of stick in there. Sabalenka couldn't get over the line in that match. And similarly, in the US Open final, it's hard not to say that the crowd and the atmosphere and, you know, the fact it was Coco Gauff opposite, who was such an overawing favourite, didn't really play into that match. So I still think there's steps forward Sabalenka can take, and a large part of those are mental steps. But I think she'll keep putting herself in positions this season. It wouldn't surprise me for her to win one or two Grand Slams. And I think she goes into this tournament probably the favourite for me in some ways. I don't think this is Świątek's best tournament by any stretch of the imagination. Go toe-to-toe with Sabalenka, that for me is always a 50-50 match, just who's hitting it slightly cleaner on the day they both play so similarly. I think those three are the players you'd be looking at. Gauff has obviously shown a little bit of form in the warm-up as well, but I think if Sabalenka and Rybakina are hitting as well as they can, they're going to be the two who are the hardest to stop here.
Hmm. If you are a big Sabalenka fan, Nikos, which I know you are, and I know lots of other people will be, the first episode of Netflix's Breakpoint Season 2 will be very much to your liking. I've just got early access to them. I'm only one episode in, but Aryna Sabalenka's Australian Open win is very much at the forefront of that first episode. Some quite good insights into her working with Jason Stacey, who is her, I think his technical term is performance coach. But he has been doing a lot of work with her on mindset and performance. And I tell you what was very interesting, George, was just hearing him chastise a kind of other member of the team, a peripheral member, for saying he was nervous about the upcoming match. And he was like, don't let her hear you say that. Like, even if you're, like, you know, nearby, if she hears that, then it goes in. And I don't think he's being Sabalenka specific. I think he's saying you need to exude this energy of relaxation to your player. And there's a similar kind of thing with Sakkari and her coach, Tom Hill, where she has a go at him for, like, they're preparing for, I can't remember who it is, one of the Chinese players. And Tom Hill says, oh, you know, she's got a really good forehand, so I'm going to get your hitter to, like, shoot some to you. And she's like, why would you say that to me? Like, why would you say she's got a good forehand? Like, you're freaking me out, like, before a match. Which I think it's quite interesting, George. Surely you need to know that kind of info.
Yeah, I mean, I find this sort of thing. Obviously, these guys, I'm sure, are far more qualified than I am. But for me, I think there's something important about acknowledging the nerves and kind of knowing they're there and actually thinking about how you handle them and want to change them. To me, like, running away and pretending they're not there doesn't feel like a strong... I mean, I'm sure there's some kind of rooted logic in this, but, you know, I think we've seen, not to keep banging on about Novak in this podcast, but, you know, we've seen matches where Novak's definitely feeling the nerves and, you know, rolling in second serves at kind of no sort of pace. And he's quite honest about, you know, he feels nerves. I think I've heard Roger say he felt really nervous coming into, you know, even first round matches. And
well, we know Roger gets tight. I mean, that's hardest.
But even in like matches that aren't that significant, you know, I think all these top guys acknowledge there is a feeling of nerves. And I think it's more about how you settle with those nerves and how you try not to let it affect you in the big moments. And, you know, Novak's probably been the best player at that throughout his career in terms of in the moments that are the tightest, which is often the tie breaks, and why we have drummed on about that Wimbledon tie break against Alcaraz being so surprising that he sort of did play like someone who was feeling the nerves when we know he just turns into human backboard mode normally. It's how you just make sure you are not the one who's going to feel the nerves more than the bloke at the other end of the net. Because I think the acknowledgement of the nerves to me is also the acknowledgement that the guy at the other end is going to be feeling like that, or, you know, your opponent. And it's about how you deal with those nerves. If you're not acknowledging the threat of that in the first place, it feels like, oh yeah, this is just another willy-nilly point. And if you just go and smack it and miss completely, then really you're not feeling the match in the moment. So I don't know if it feels kind of instinctively right to me to deal like that. And, you know, without being harsh, we're talking about two players who've won one Grand Slam between them there. And I think Sabalenka certainly should win more Grand Slams, and Sakkari, you know, has had chances to win Grand Slams. That French Open, where she was kind of, I think, the highest seed left in the quarters or semi-finals.
Semis, she had match points, yeah.
Went to pot. So...
I mean, she retired for 4 days after that. Like, she rang her coach and said, I'm quitting, like, I'm done. And then actually realised that she wasn't quite done. Well, thanks for your question, Nikos. I know there are others on that same email, and we'll get to them over the weeks, I hope, when the right people are present and when the right moment arises. Another thing he just mentions in passing. I remember a chat a while ago about the best tournaments to visit, and I'll absolutely echo others that Kitzbühel is phenomenal. Beautiful town and court, great crowd, atmosphere, tons of nice activities that time of year, like hiking, mountain biking, taking the gondola if you're lazy, a beautiful lake, live music. I've been to the town several times, so I can give you some good recs of stuff to do, places to go there as well. Thanks, Nikos.
So it could be a good nomination for Tennis Unfiltered Abroad, Kitzbühel.
Yeah, could well be. Although it's in the middle of the summer, Kitzbühel, isn't it? Or is that the one that's later in the... I'm not sure. Anyway... let's move on. Let's get into the running order itself, I reckon, George. We talked about Rafa. Let's talk about Emma Raducanu, who's another player on the injury comeback this year. She's been in action in Auckland, picking up a win in her first match, but then beaten by Alina Svitolina. A match, I said, bore just more positives than negatives. On Twitter, and apparently that was an unreasonable take. It was too negative. Despite saying that it was actually a more positive match than negative, it was too negative.
Mentioning the word negative is negative, James.
Which I give up. I give up with that. So, I mean, I saw yesterday, I sort of came to the realization, and I know that this is not new news, that Twitter is not a place for serious people. When I saw like some conspiracy theorist had come up with some reason that a United pilot had been fired and rehired so that they could hit their diversity numbers, and then something, even though they weren't allowed to fly, and Joe Barton had like quote retweeted it being like, this is unbelievable if it's true. It's like, if, for starters, I hate it when people are like, oh, if they like broadcast something and go, if this is true, it's big. And then I looked in the replies and Elon Musk was also like, oh, this is bad if it's true. And I was like, right, this is no longer a forum for serious debate or information.
I can't believe we've just allowed Joey Barton to be mentioned on our podcast. He is an impossible twat. The fact he's getting any coverage at the minute is feeding into exactly what he wants. So,
yes, yeah, exactly.
That's the only coverage he deserves, is being called an impossible twat. I'll say it again.
An impossible twat. That's an impossible twat. That's quite a good phrase, George. I like that. Anyway, quite aside from that, Emma Raducanu lost in three sets to Aliona Svitolina. She was a couple of points away from victory in the second set tiebreak. Held her own with one of the form players, certainly one of the form defenders in world tennis, George, but was heavily strapped to one of her thighs and certainly went away in the third set physically and was holding her back. I mean, is that just sort of what you'd expect from someone who's been out for a long time, or is that maybe a sign that the physical condition still isn't there?
I think it can be a bit of both to a degree. I think, you know, as I said earlier with Rafa, when you've come back from a lengthy layoff, it's often other parts of the body that struggle as much as that injured area. You know, you've probably really focused your rehab on making sure that wrist is kind of perfect, or, you know, as perfect as it can be, or you're getting you comfortable in believing there's not an issue there. But, you know, that I'm not saying that comes at the neglect of other areas, but it's quite a natural thing that that's the kind of center of your focus. And then when you're actually kind of getting back into match situations and your body's doing that extra, whatever, 5% that it's hard to drive it to do in practice, it's quite likely that things don't work as they should, or you kind of feel things a little bit more when you're rusty a long way off match practice. I mean, for what it's worth, I think Raducanu achieved basically what I thought she could achieve this week. You know, it was a good first round draw. That was a match she is and was capable of winning. You know, there were obviously some nerves in the back end of that match, and it wasn't necessarily pretty, but really important for her just to get that winning feeling back, which she's not really had for, what, 10, 11 months longer? I can't really remember the last time she won a match. And then she played someone who, let's be honest, was really strong last year and beating a lot of top opponents, and someone who's also come back for different reasons and been very motivated and, you know, beaten the world number one at Grand Slam, come through big feisty matches against former world number one and Grand Slam champion at the same tournament, picking up big back-to-back wins, and someone who's been top four in the world before. So it's no surprise to me she lost that match. And she competed pretty well for two sets. So, and I think I'm right in saying Svitolina went on to have a couple of results straight afterwards that were pretty heavy-handed on other opponents that probably...
She got to the final. She absolutely battered Marie Buzkova and beat Wang Jianyu. Wang Jianyu. You know, who are both very capable players and you know, well inside top 100. So, yeah, as you say, George, it's not a great shame to lose to Aliona Svitolina, I think. I think my point was that, you know, but by most people's account, Emma Raducanu's tennis level has never really been in question. You know, we think, believe to varying degrees that she's a top 30 player probably, or top 40, certainly in terms of her, you know, her kind of 80% level. And that's where we think she probably should be ranked, about 35 in the world at the moment. Anyway, she's still developing. And so to hold her own with Aliona Svitolina, it's like, well, yeah, we know that. Like, and so the question has not been for the last 2 years, is Emma Raducanu good enough? I don't think we ever really say that. The question has been, is Emma Raducanu fit enough? And so, yes, it's only her second match back. And like, I'm not going to sit here and say she's blown the opportunity to make a huge step forward physically. But when I say there are negatives, you know, that concern me, it is that, you know, all of a sudden it was a big strapping on the thigh. And okay, it didn't seem to hinder her, but that, you know, it's another thing. But what she said afterwards was, you can't replicate 3 hours of intensity in training. And I imagine it's very hard. It's something I really admire Rafa Nadal for, and Novak Djokovic. Both of them, when they come back, like, they're at such a high level of intensity straight away. And I'm convinced it's because they have found a way to replicate that intensity in training. And maybe that's a mindset thing as much as anything else. So it'll come. She's going to play a charity match on Tuesday night in Melbourne. And that'll be 7:30 a.m. kickoff UK time on Tuesday morning against Naomi Osaka, which has created a lot of excitement online, as you might expect. And she's also going to go to Kooyong and I think play Mira Andreeva in the Kooyong Classic, which is an exhibition tournament at a venue that used to hold the Australian Open long, long time ago. I've never been up to Kooyong, so I'm going to head up there on Wednesday. Yeah, it's a bit of a laugh.
That'll be fun.
Yeah, I think so. So that, you know, that's an opportunity for her to get some competitive practice in, essentially. You know, they are exhibitions, but there will also be some high-level hitting. I also think, the Osaka match could be on labour, although they haven't actually confirmed that. But I think just the opportunity to get on a big court again, and, you know, I think she's always said, oh, I don't really see it, you know, I don't feel it anymore, because she's played on big courts in front of big crowds. But when you haven't done it for, you know, 9 months, I imagine you do sort of forget what it's like. And, you know, she's not played on labour loads. I mean, yeah. I think she's played on labour twice, maybe.
It's not including... so familiar that it will be second nature to it.
Yeah, exactly.
By virtue of she's only played, what, 5 Grand Slams, maybe?
Six, well, yeah, exactly. And she wasn't fully fit last time she played on labour because her ankle was in bits and her wrists were hurting. So, yeah, I wait with interest, really. I mean, what do you think would be a good result for Emma Raducanu at the Australian Open, George?
I mean, for her, it's going to depend on the draw, isn't it? Let's be honest. I mean, if she draws Iga Swiatek first round, then a competitive lot is a good result. If she draws the world number 32, who I can't pick out of my brain.
Vavara Gracheva might be around there. Yeah. If I've got that, I've got to have to check, George, if I've got that.
That'd be world-class picking.
Oh, I'm close. Close. She's 39. Lesya Sorenko is world number 32.
So, like, if she's drawing a kind of lower seed or gets a kind of non-seeded player who then goes on to a lower seed in the second round, I think a good result is second or third round.
Hmm. I mean, fourth round's like top 3% of results, right?
Yeah, definitely. I'd be, given what we're talking about in terms of her physical potential issues already, that would be a really good result. I mean, yeah, look, second week of any slam for someone who's not an established top 8 player is a good result, regardless of who you are, for me. So that would be good. My current feeling is I'll be surprised if she goes past the second round, to be honest.
Because that involves playing a seeded player and probably most of the seeds at the moment. I mean, there are exceptions, but yeah, I would probably agree with you. I think it would be big for her to win the first round. Like, I think it would be big for her. I don't think she lacks confidence. I don't think she needs confidence. I think she's a very confident player and has huge faith in her own ability. But I think it would just be a good thing overall. Also for us.
I was gonna say, for you lot, it'll be a disappointing trip if you lose Raducanu and Murray first round, won't it?
Yeah. Yeah, oh God, yeah, exactly. right, well, let's move on. The other comeback, I've kind of alluded to it there, Naomi Osaka, who has been out for 15 months, I think I'm right in saying, having had her first child. Congratulations, of course. She beat Tamara Korpach in the first round, 11-9 in a second set tiebreak, and then lost to Karolina Pliskova in 3 pretty competitive sets. I don't know what we were expecting, George. It's very hard to know what to expect from Naomi Osaka at the best of times, but she was speaking quite openly, which I think is always a reflection of her mindset. You know, I think you can... It's the funny thing with Naomi Osaka, because she's so introverted, I actually think that it's easier to tell kind of how she's feeling. Mm. Like, I often think with extroverted people, they're always up. They're always, you know, talking a lot and talking about X, Y, and Z. Whereas, you know, with Naomi Osaka, you know that if she's not saying anything, then, you know, she's not feeling great. But I think she looks like she's genuinely happy to be back on tour.
Yeah, and I think there were some nice quotes I was reading where she spoke about how she's not walking around tournament sites with her headphones on now and is actually willing to engage with other players. And almost, I don't know if she exactly said this, but it felt a bit to me like there was a, and I don't think it's in the same way as how Sharapova used to say it, like kind of us and them sort of thing. It's just more of like from her perspective of being that introverted figure that she felt quite hard, quite difficult to reach out to other people in the locker room and view them as people rather than competitors. Yeah, as I said, not from the vantage point of Sharapova being like, I hate you all because you're my competitor, but like, you know, just maybe finding it difficult to find trust and warmth in people that you know are going for the same thing as you, which I think is, you know, maybe quite a natural reaction in some ways. So yeah, she does definitely feel more at ease. I think she wouldn't be the only player, you know, we've spoken about Svitolina before. I think there's a degree to which going away and doing something more real life in inverted commas probably does ground you a little bit, probably does kind of open up the perspectives that these things, of course they matter, of course they're really important, of course they've like driven you your entire life, but there is more to life, and actually seeing that more to life can maybe focus you to put the right sort of energy towards it and not, you know, really get too focused and centered and, you know, uptight and feeling horrible. So yeah, I think it'll be really interesting because let's not beat around the bush with this. You know, if Naomi Osaka was fit and firing, and similarly for Ash Barty for the last couple of years, we would have had probably one of the golden eras of women's tennis with Iga Swiatek kicking around. You know, Osaka was that good, and she would be the favorite for this tournament if she was coming in as the Naomi Osaka we knew before. She'd be the favorite for every hard court slam at the minute, and I think Sabalenka would be just behind her. You know, this is a seriously good player with serious weapons. I don't think she's going to win this tournament, but I think she, by the time the US Open comes round, if she is in this sort of mindset, getting the matches she needs, focusing enough on her tennis while still, you know, not letting those mental challenges she's had in the past kind of consume her, I think this is a player who can easily get back to that level. And it's not for me as much a question of whether Raducanu can get back to the level of getting close to winning Grand Slams. You know, I'm certain Osaka's got that within her if the other conditions are right. So, yeah, I think this will come soon, but she can reach the fourth round of this tournament, make no odds about it. You know, she's good enough. If she gets the right draw, she's going to be a threat there. And she's the sort of player that if you let find form and you do see her in the second week, you're suddenly thinking, can she? And yeah, so I think it's quite exciting. And, you know, she's a big personality. She's someone everyone, I mean, everyone is in outside of tennis knows as well. I think, you know, if you ask people in the UK who they know as tennis players, Naomi Osaka is going to be one of the top six they can name, I would have thought, both men and women.
It's a great question, George, and one I can literally look up thanks to YouGov's great polling on this stuff. I would guess she's maybe just outside the top 10 in terms of
what, of
fame.
Active?
Huh?
But of active players, I'm saying.
They regard it as contemporary. That's okay, so she's 15th in contemporary. But, I mean, the list is like Murray, Serena, Roger, Rafa, Venus, Novak, Sharapova, Raducanu, Jamie Murray, Heather Watson, Caroline Wozniacki, Joe Konta, Laura Robson, Leighton Hewitt, Naomi Osaka.
So I think
you're not far off.
Names that are not playing there, so of active, I think I'm pretty close. But
yeah, pretty good. Yeah, I think it's huge. The million-dollar question, George, although I suppose it's not, but and I think I know your answer. Who goes further, Raducanu or Osaka? And in Melbourne?
I mean, again, you know, not to cop out, it does hugely depend on the
score. You've copped out.
If either of them gets Swiatek first round, they're going to lose that match. But yeah, I think Osaka can win. I wouldn't be surprised to see Osaka in the third or fourth round of this.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't, to be honest, I wouldn't be that surprised to see her in the quarterfinals or semis. I would be surprised if she won it. But she, you know,
I think quarters, yeah, because a quarter can open up. But I think if she goes and makes the semis, I'd be pretty, pretty surprised. I think. Right, let's move on to. Well, I'm kind of. I'm interested in Andy Murray. I'm interested in Harriet Dart. And I'm interested in the Grigor Dimitrov storyline. So, George, I'm going to let you pick which one of those players you want to talk about first.
Well, I think seeing as Dimitrov just won this morning, I think that's a good one to go to. You know,
first and that his news has been massively overshadowed by Rafa pulling out the Australian Open about 5 minutes later.
Yeah. That was his first title since 2017, which I couldn't really believe in some ways.
Like, is that since ATP World Tour Finals? Or was that 2016 he won that? It is. It's since Tour Finals in 2017. Yeah. That was his last title.
Yeah. Yeah, because Murray won it the year before, didn't he, for World Number 1?
Yeah, for World Number 1. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think the reason I think this is worth talking about as much as anything, obviously, you know, Dimitrov, a nice enough guy, he's plays some really nice tennis to watch, but actually if you look at the level he was at in the back end of last year that he's brought into the new year winning a title, I mean, this is a guy who's been, for me, playing top 5-6 level really on the men's side in terms of quality of performances over the last couple of months. I think Dimitrov's not a guy you want to see in your draw right now. He's hitting freely. He's playing really well. He's obviously been to semis in Australia in the past. Seeing people like Rafa go out for me is huge for a player like Dimitrov, because if you put Rafa across the net against Dimitrov, you think there's so much mental scarring there. But if you put a Jannik Sinner opposite Dimitrov on the net, you know, Sinner's the favourite for that match, but it's not as mental a thing for Dimitrov to win that match. I think Dimitrov's a bit of a dangerous floater for people like Alcaraz and Sinner, in the sense of, you know, he'll have much more belief he can get that result than if he turns up against Djokovic, I think. So I think his placement in the draw is going to be quite interesting. Again, I don't think he's going to win the Australian Open, but it's nice to see him playing freely. It's nice to see him bringing this tennis we know is in there. It's just a question of whether in the later stages of a big tournament, whether he can hold his head together. And I suspect the answer is probably still no, particularly if it's Novak on the other end of the net. But don't be surprised if he does some damage in the fourth round to a player we think should be going to the semis, would be my big mystic prediction.
Don't be surprised if does some damage. I mean, this has all the hallmarks for classic George Belshaw prediction, because it's not really clear what it is or specifically why. I tell you what, George, the stat I posted from Tennis Insights in our WhatsApp group last week, which is the top 10 forehands and top 10 backhands on the ATP Tour, Grigor Dimitrov's forehand is fifth on the tour in terms of quality. And you know, for anyone who doesn't know, Tennis Insights work with the ATP to provide these stats. Shot quality is calculated based on spin, speed, depth, width, but also on the ball coming in. So it's kind of a more exhaustive rating.
And it has Calvin's seal of approval, doesn't it? He likes it.
Yes, yeah, exactly. Which is all, it's hard enough to gain, so I think we should give it some credit. But yeah, Novak, Alcaraz, Tsitsipas, Sinner, and then Dimitrov. And I think I haven't got the serving stats in front of me, but he's always, certainly in the latter part of his career, he's always very high up in the serving stats. You know, that's become like a real weapon for him.
To prove we're not an anti-Novak pod, I believe Novak's top of forehand and backhand.
Which, oh, yes, he's the best player.
He's the best player.
People might be interested to note maybe the two most surprising names on the whole thing. Number 7 on the backhands, Richard Gasquet.
It's a lovely shot, though.
It's a lovely looking shot, but I would always have been like, oh, it just looks nice.
His forehand's crap, isn't it?
that's what he does. He runs around all the really short balls so he can hit the backhand. But the AI of Tennis Insights would not be fooled by that, because it takes into account the incoming ball. But number 10, Jack Draper, which I'm taking some credit for, because, well, partly because Jack Draper himself said it to me, but also because I genuinely think his backhand is a real weapon and it's a really good shot. Anyway, I'm getting distracted. Right, Grigor Dimitrov's going to win the Australian Open. Glad we've cleared that up. Just get your money on him now, I reckon. Harriet Dart reaching the Canberra final.
I thought you were about to say Harriet Dart's going to win the Australian. That's the maddest prediction I've ever
heard. Get your money on that. yeah, congrats to Harriet Dart for making the final of the Canberra Challenger. She's obviously the British number three at the moment. She's going to play Australian Open qualies. I just wanted to mention it because it's nice when people do well to say well done. Let's move on to Andy Murray, George. He was talking to Russell Fuller, the BBC's tennis correspondent out in Brisbane this week, and kind of talking through what's been a pretty tough pre-season again. And I think for the first time publicly, really acknowledging that this might well be his last season.
Yeah. I mean, it's a classic Murray acknowledgement, isn't it? Where it's like, oh, it depends how it's going, doesn't it? Yeah, if I'm not enjoying my tennis, then...
For listeners, George is currently rubbing his eye with the back of his hand in what is George Belfour's signature Andy Murray impression.
But yeah, you know, he's a bit like me, isn't he, Murray, really, in terms of committing to something. He'll sort of say, yeah, could be this, but might be that. And yeah.
It's always funny when you ring up, like... You know, people we know around the Murray camp usually just to say, like, where's he playing next week? And they're all like, we have no idea. Like, he has a wild card here and he's entered here and we are just waiting for him to pull the trigger. And he is notoriously indecisive, right?
Yeah. And I think if there's another 6 months to come, like the previous 6 months, I think it's done at Wimbledon, to be honest.
Do you think? Not even playing
the
Olympics.
Yeah, sorry, Olympics.
But I just can't see him retiring. I mean, retiring in Paris. I don't know. I think maybe the thing is, I don't think he wants to make a huge song and dance about it. I think everyone else wants to make a big song and dance about it. You know, we all remember the Australian Open when he didn't retire.
he definitely did retire.
Well, yeah, I mean, he did, obviously. But, you know, that was 4 years ago. But... I think he will find it so hard to retire that, can you imagine if they did, like, you know, when at the French Open last year, Joe Wilfried Tsonga, and they did a big on-court thing, like all of the Golden Generation turned up. He was there for about half an hour. There was a band. I mean, Murray would just be crying for the whole thing. Like it would be unbearable. It would be horrible. It would be almost unpleasant. He'd get dehydrated. And I don't know if he wants to go through that in front of everybody ever again. You know, after what's the famous line? I'm gonna try. when Sue Barker gave him the microphone. And so in that sense, I'm kind of contradicting myself and saying, well, maybe he will retire at the Olympics. And just, you know, I know he wants to play them. He's desperate to play them. And, you know, that's the sort of general idea. But whether he then goes on and plays the US as well, goes in New York maybe, you know, where it all started to an extent?
Yeah, I mean, I did say if he has the same 6 months as he had the last 6 months, I mean,
yeah,
it's perfectly feasible that Andy Murray can reach the third round in Australia with the right sort of draw. I mean, he had chances to, you know, we've spoken about the tournament that disappointed us most last season, probably a single player, was Murray at Wimbledon, you know. Mm. Should have beaten Tsitsipas. He could have beaten Tsitsipas. And then that draw flew wide open to the point where you're playing, you know, Chris Eubanks in the last 16 or whatever it was.
Yeah.
You know, that was a great opportunity for Murray to really have that slam run that's been missing from this hip comeback, really. In some ways, kind of Australia's probably the one he feels most comfortable at outside of Wimbledon. I know he's won the US Open early on, but actually this is the tournament I think he's reached the final five times. Plays good stuff there, likes the atmosphere, always has some kind of really epic matches. You know, you guys have discussed the Kokkinakis match that you both, you know, got really into last year. He had a big one with Berrettini as well, didn't he? You know, he loves it out there and plays some good stuff generally. So yeah, I think it's not beyond him to have a decent run again. Cue a first round draw with Djokovic or something now. but yeah, I don't know. He's hard to read, isn't he? It feels it feels he's somewhat at odds when I hear him talk about what he wants from his career now. Like, there's part of him that seems to be accepting of being 40 in the world, but then you watch a guy on the court, how he's reacting to things, you don't really know if he's just kind of saying that publicly but not truly accepting it within.
Yeah.
I think he thinks his tennis is top 20, top even top 10, I think, occasionally. Mm. It's just there's more to it than just hitting the ball, isn't there? You know, and we've spoken about this. Is he going to pull the trigger on that backhand down the line when it really matters? Is he going to take that short ball on, or is he going to just keep it in there? You know, is he going to meet Alex de Minaur and blow 100 breakpoint leads or something? You know, there's just so much more going on than just his tennis. So yeah, I think it'll be an interesting year for him. I hope he has a good Australia, because, you know, we all want him to keep going, really, don't we? I think there'd be something quite magical about a Murray run at Wimbledon where he reaches the quarterfinals. I think we've all given up on him winning a Grand Slam now. I've certainly haven't given up on that long time ago. But I haven't given up on him having that run to the second week of a Slam, and it could be this one.
The thing is, look, home players light up Slams. Like that. I know partly we're a British podcast, and that's why we get excited about Murray, and, you know, we've all had our own dealings with him in our own ways. And that's the other reason. But it's also that Wimbledon is a big part of the tennis calendar. You know, it's one of the four biggest tournaments of the year. And the matches where a home player gets the crowd behind him are special. I mean, that the Oscar Otter five-setter under the roof remains one of the most insane noises I've ever heard from a crowd of any sport. You know, kind of amplified because of the roof, amplified because Murray was picking people out in the front row to give the fist pump to and to get fired up with. And also the fact that it was a guy no one had really heard of, but who played lights out. Like, he obviously got a massive serve, which helps. But
another guy looks like me.
Does he? You haven't got an earring. If you get your ear pierced, George, then I'll give you the Oscar.
Said it for both, so it must be true. The internet's never wrong, James.
So those moments are important. And look, there are other players. Jack Draper is coming fast, and Cam Norrie made a semi-final. Like, you know, those players do exist, but Murray has such kind of baggage with the great British public. You know, everyone knows who he is. And I think people have been through a real journey with Andy Murray as well. Like, not just his career journey, but he wasn't always very popular. You know, that the anyone but England thing that was basically just a gag, but really set him back. Like, people took it really personally. And I still know English people who are like, no, I don't like Andy Murray. He hates English people. And it's like, mate, he lives in Surrey. Like, he's married to an English woman. Like, all of his kids are English. Like, anyway, it's neither here nor there. But he has obviously kind of won a lot of people round because of the vulnerability, the resurfacing documentary with Amazon, I think, had a big impact on that. And so I think there's a huge amount of goodwill. He's not perfect. And I think his behavior on court, especially over the last like couple of months, been pretty poor. You know, Paris in particular was pretty, pretty ordinary stuff. Not in terms of the tennis, although the tennis wasn't great either, but just in terms of how he carried himself. And I think he will look back and look at that and think maybe he could have done things differently. So, yeah, I don't want him to not enjoy it, but it's this constant thing, right? If he enjoys it, he's not going to retire. He has to go through the horror and act like a child on a tennis court in order to make him stop. But really, he just needs to stop, because then all the pain goes away.
It could be 5.5 months of absolute dross, and then he might reach the final in Rosmalen and suddenly be like, right,
he won't. Yeah, I suppose so. Is it Rosmalen he plays? No, it's Stuttgart he plays.
Oh, has he not played Herzogenbosch as well?
He may have played that once, but he made the final. He's played Stuttgart the last 2 years.
Okay, fair enough. Yeah. Well, he might go there, get himself back to Rosmalen. It's all going wrong.
That'd be good. I'd quite like to go to Rosmalen. That would give me an excuse to go. Anyway, let's just do a quick roundup of some other things that have been going on over the last week. The United Cup, which I hadn't really realised how long the United Cup is now. It's been going on for like 12 days or something. But it's produced some good tennis. Poland have been looking outstanding. The final is ongoing as we speak. Alexander Zverev and Hubert Hurkacz have just split two tiebreaks, which surprises nobody, given their particular styles of play. But that's only about the second set Poland have dropped in the entire tournament. And Germany, meanwhile, have had to battle to the final. They had an absolute heartbreaker, but it was a tiebreaker, against Australia. It went to 3 o'clock in the morning in Sydney. Kerber beat Tomljanovic in three sets, 9-7 in the third set breaker. Dumanur beat Zverev in three sets from a set down. And then the doubles went to two tiebreaks and then a deciding tiebreak that was 15-13 to Siegmund and Zverev against Storm Hunter and Matthew Ebden. To kind of come back to the point I've just made, George, home success always makes these tournaments, you know, come to life. And if the home team doesn't do well, it sometimes can be the death of a tournament. I think we had to give a huge amount of credit to Alex de Minaur, who has just basically lit up a tournament against the odds. The only person to beat him in singles is Cam Norrie, would you believe it? He's beaten Taylor Fritz, Novak Djokovic and Alexander Zverev. I mean, it's a stellar run.
It's a great start to the year, yeah. And you're absolutely right, you know, having that home favourite at these tournaments really does bring it to life, even if it's not the home favourite of the people reporting on it. You know, we do want people like, obviously it's not there this year, but Kyrgios, Kokkinakis, two matches by bringing in what is, you know, pretty raucous, heavily supportive drinking culture fan base, really. And, you know, it does add something to it. And, you know, Dimonor's probably that player we all think won't go past the quarterfinals, really. And I think if he gets to the quarterfinals, that would be a great result to him. But he's having big results against big players in the last 6 months, particularly, I would say. You know, there has been, to me, a little bit of a change in terms of his mindset against those biggest players. The win over Djokovic, particularly big. Obviously, you know, Novak's fiddling with his wrist or whatever. Don't know how engaged he is at points compared to others. You know, could he do the same over five sets at the Australian Open? Probably not. But still, I do think he's a player. Certainly Medvedev won't want to see. That's not a style that's really matched up with him well in the past. I think he can cause Sinner problems. I'd say to a degree, even Alcaraz wouldn't be that pleased to see him. I think Novak's probably the one who still, again, just by being Novak, I'd put all my money on Novak winning against Dimonor in a best of five sets Grand Slam match. But the others who've had bits of scarring, who aren't as experienced in that format, I think Dimonor's another player like Dimitrov, just really don't want to be seeing in your section of the draw. And it's probably possible. I can't remember where they're all seeded. Is it possible to have Dimitrov and Dimonor in the same part of the draw? Probably not.
Dimonor is 12 and Dimitrov is 14, so unlikely.
But yeah. Anyway.
In fact, yes, no, they're in the exact same category. Yeah. So yeah, they can't be in the same section. But
that's a relief, I would say.
Yes, to all of us. Yes, that is what, that when players are sitting down having dinner on like Wednesday night before the draw, they'll be like, you know, so glad Dimonur and Dimitrov are ranked within three places of each other. It just means you can't play them in like consecutive rounds, which would be the absolute nightmare. That's exactly what they're all saying to each other. But yeah, I mean, it's good for Alex Dimonur to be doing the thing, I think. Even if perhaps we think that victory over Novak Djokovic might be a bit of a false friend, so to speak. We've got on our list to do predictions, George, for the year.
Probably better.
Tricky Calvin, without Calvin here.
Yeah.
Because, but so what we'll do, George, is I will track down Calvin in Melbourne. I will find him on a practice court and we'll do some predictions courtside. I'll do a call with you in the middle of next week.
Okay.
And we'll put it all together because that's the best way. Sort of housekeeping, Fantasy Tennis is back. FTU, Fantasy Tennis Unfiltered, is back as of next week. As always, you cannot enter until the draw is done. You then have, and I'm going to be a bit generous this year because the Australian Open starts on Sunday, which could limit the amount of time for people to enter. So I'm going to say that you've got until the end or till the beginning of play on Monday. So, you know, in theory, if your player loses first round on Sunday, you can go in and change your team. Like, I'll allow that. Like, just because we've got to give some flexibility to people. Yeah. Now, what that should mean is that you could be a bit tactical with that and say, right, I've got a free hit on a couple of these Sunday qualifiers. So maybe just, you know, you can sort of get 2-for-1 there. But if you've got that much time in your hands, then great. Anyway, I will get things sorted after the draw on Thursday for people to sign up. There'll be a link on our Twitter, at Unfiltered Tennis. It'll be on the Substack, which I'm going to send next week. Do sign up for our Tennis Unfiltered Substack newsletter, by the way. They are random musings from either me or George and occasionally Calvin, and they are sent at random intervals. I cannot say monthly, I cannot say weekly, but they sometimes drop into your inbox. Where else will I put? I'll put a link in, hopefully, in the description to this podcast as well. And if not, then the next one. And we'll try and do some draw analysis, George, as well, if yes. We can make things work on Thursday. Might have to get you out of bed early, heaven forbid. Yeah, you don't look delighted about that.
We can definitely do something.
Yes.
I believe we're planning on making a race of our own for the year.
The other two bits of fancy housekeeping. First of all, there will be an order of merit for this year. Yeah, a race to nowhere. That's what we should call it, the race to nowhere, because there is no FTU World Tour Finals. But yes, so if you
predicting the tour finals,
if you use the same team name for each of the Grand Slams, then excuse me, I will be able to combine all your points. And we can see who the true...
Or at least put your Twitter handle in, I guess. You could potentially...
The same team name, George.
Same team name, okay.
I've made it very clear. And I know the piece of code that I'm using, and it requires you to use the same team name.
Okay.
And we'll combine...
That one's tougher. I change mine every tournament.
So well, you're going to have to come up with a good one then. And yeah, we'll combine the points from all four slams. We really will know. Thanks to Stan Tuchel. He's a French journalist for that idea on Twitter. And yeah, we'll make it happen. And finally, if you win FTU Australian Open, there's a prize.
Ooh.
Well done, everyone. Which is an exclusive piece of Tennis Unfiltered merch. Yes, you heard me right. Tennis Unfiltered merch. TBC exactly what it looks like or what it is, but I assure you it's merch. And we will get it out in the post to you if you do, in fact, win hashtag FTU. If the winner is uncontactable within 7 days at the end of the tournament, you'll get a prize for coming second. So and so forth and so on. So it could well be that I'm just mailing something to George in 170th place, but we'll see how that goes down. So yeah, please do take part. Please do make sure you're listening to all our podcasts. We will, as always, try and do a daily podcast, sometimes during the slam, that is. Sometimes that's just going to be me burbling. Sometimes it'll be me calling George at some... Well, to be honest, George... Oh, no, God. Sorry, my phone's making a noise. To be honest, George, most of the time it's like 5 p.m. your time because I'm working at 5 a.m. Or even the most famous one, which is when I came back from Murray Kokkinakis and did a podcast with you and Calvin at what I think was 8 p.m. UK or 6 p.m. UK time.
It was definitely after work, yeah.
Yeah. And it was 7 a.m. in Melbourne. It was horrific. But yeah, I don't know if you've got any other business, George. If people have sat through the admin, you might be able to give them an Easter egg of tennis news.
Tennis news? Can't really think of anything. Actually.
Oh, come on, George. Be creative. Some Belshaw news. What's the reaction to your interview been like? Have you had people telling you they're surprised at how little you know about Sutton
Park?
Oh, God,
yeah. Well, so my mum actually listened to it. And she wanted me to make a public apology for misleading the Tennis Unfiltered public.
Oh, amazing. What did you lie about?
Well, I didn't lie per se, but she wasn't very pleased that I'd insinuated that I only got into sport via my brother when she says she has a long rap sheet of her achievements at school, kind of netball and things like this. And she's very sporty and... Actually, she wanted more credit for getting me involved in sport in the first place. So I had to issue that correction. She also pointed out that in the description of the podcast, it says my dad was a doctor when he was a solicitor.
A doctor of law, maybe, George.
That's it. So that was the main reaction, my mum telling me off.
What's your mum's name, George?
Marion.
Marion,
Maz,
I can
only... as we call her.
Maz?
Yeah.
Right. Well, Maz, I can only apologise on behalf of your incompetent son. I have, in fact, just in the last few seconds, been made aware via the internet of your amazing achievements. They've never seen a netball player like you, I hear. So thank you so much for giving us George Belshaw in all of his glory. If you haven't gone back and listened, George is our mystery guest. That was how little I give to your name, George. I build you as a mystery guest.
I noticed that. Like, they're bigging up Calvin. Everyone's like, oh, yeah, got to get on that. Like, mystery guest now.
But yeah, if you go Christmas back and listen to our Christmas Day episode, you'll hear an interview with George and get to know his life a bit better. And our New Year's Day episode, which is me and Calvin talking about the life of Calvin Betson.
I really enjoyed listening.
Good. I'm glad. Yeah, I mean, it was fascinating. I'm sorry he's not here for me to say what an interesting guy he is. But
I'm sure he'll be listening back. He never misses an episode, I'm sure.
Yes, he definitely hasn't got anything better to do, like, you know, try and win a 250 this week or anything like that. But anyway, listen, thanks so much for joining us, as always. Make sure you leave us a rating, a review, and all those important things. Vote for us in the Sports Podcast Awards. There'll be a link in the description. That's still open for another couple of weeks, but vote early.
When does voting close for that?
January 28th, I believe.
Okay, so we've got some time.
Vote early and vote often, George. That's my moniker.
Vote with multiple email addresses. Create new email addresses.
I don't know if we're allowed to
hire
tell people.
Russian
to do that.
Bot farm.
That's what we need. The Russians will be on our team. Sports Social Podcast Network.